Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
And now, a road report from Siemens Energy.
The road to energy resilience
is long and winding.
But step by step,
we're making progress.
With renewable energy,
with stronger grid technologies,
hydrogen-ready gas turbines
and e-fuels
for hard-to-decarbonize industries,
we are driving towards that destination every day.
Step by step, we are getting there.
Find out how at siemensenergy.com.
Let's make tomorrow different today.
From hedge funds to angel investors to bull markets, in the world of finance, names can sometimes be a bit misleading. Take ours, for instance. LSEG, a.k.a. London Stock Exchange Group. We're in London, and we have a stock exchange, but that's just part of what we do. Today, we connect the news, information, insights, and systems that make the markets work. You see, others do some of what we do, but not everything we do. LSEG.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 10th of November, these are our main stories. Israel says it will observe four-hour pauses every day in the war in Gaza after pressure from the US.
We believe that this is an important step in the right direction. We believe that it is a byproduct of the US government and this administration's efforts in the region.
It comes as a video of another two hostages is released by Palestinian militants. The kidnapped father of the Liverpool footballer Luis Diaz is released by rebels in Colombia. A new study finds that lightning is the main cause of forest fires in the Northern Hemisphere. Also in this podcast, why Taiwan is stepping up its military preparedness and...
I'm so sorry, but I'm having such a perimenopausal blush right now, live on air.
We need to make it normal, and I love you for even saying it.
Praise for the contributor who experienced a menopausal hot flush on air and described it to TV viewers. The White House says Israel will implement four-hour pauses every day in areas of northern Gaza. It's raised hopes of a respite in more than a month of fighting, which has left thousands of people dead and increased fears of a regional conflict. Speaking at a news conference, the State Department spokesperson, Vedant Patel, said it was part of ongoing US efforts to ease the humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
We believe that this is an important step in the right direction. We believe that it is a byproduct of the U.S. government and this administration's efforts in the region. Of course, we are going to continue to want to see more. We have not parsed our words about the dire humanitarian circumstances in Gaza, and it's something that we're going to continue to engage on with the Israelis on what other avenues are available.
More details from our State Department correspondent, Barbara Pletusher.
These pauses seem to be very specifically related to enabling civilians to leave northern Gaza, which is the focus of the Israeli military operation, and move down towards the southern part of the strip, which is not so much in the line of fire. So according to the Israeli Defense Forces, they call it tactical local pauses for movement from a specific area, that is in the north, to the south. And they are going to be 4 hours in duration. We were told by the White House there would be a 3-hour alert ahead of time. And they would cover very specific areas. That is, safe passage corridors. There already existed one, but there's going to be a second one. And the Israelis would basically guarantee that during those 4 hours that they would cease their operations in those areas, because in the past, Palestinians have gone down a safe corridor that existed and have still sometimes been hit by results of the fighting. So that is the specific focus of this. What the White House and the State Department are saying is that they hope that this can be used in some way or as a start to try to get humanitarian pauses for aid into the Gaza Strip, more than is already coming in, and also maybe that they might be able to be used for facilitating hostage releases.
It's come, hasn't it, after the US brought a lot of pressure to bear on Israel?
Yes, this is, I think, very much the result of U.S. diplomacy. It's certainly something the State Department claims, and I think they have a case there. Secretary Blinken has been to the region twice. He's been pushing to get at least humanitarian pauses. He has an envoy in the region, David Satterfield, who's been doing the same. President Biden has been actively engaged, calling the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about this sort of thing. He was asked today, in fact, Mr. Biden, whether he had called for something much longer, for a 3-day pause to facilitate negotiations on hostages. And he said yes. In fact, he'd asked for even more than that, which he clearly didn't get. He'd asked if he was frustrated with the Israeli prime minister. And he said, well, it's taken longer than I expected to, which I think probably is a mild way of saying yes.
Barbara Plett-Usher. Meanwhile, on Thursday, Palestinian militants posted a video of two more of the Israeli hostages being held in Gaza. The footage was released as thousands more civilians headed to the south of the Gaza Strip. We'll get more on the video from our correspondent Paul Adams in Jerusalem in a moment. But first, I asked him what Israel has been saying about the humanitarian pauses.
Well, actually, the Israelis say that they are, in effect, already implementing such pauses and have been for 2 or 3 days. I mean, we have seen they have kept that road open that Barbara was referring to, a road that enables civilians to move out of the kind of main fighting area and down towards the south. You know, and that's something that has been announced ahead of time. There's been a defined window of 4, 5, and I think in one case 6 hours in which people could make their way safely down that road. Question is whether this is going to be done not just for the evacuation of civilians, but whether people who are still in the northern part, in Gaza City and the surrounding areas, might have small opportunities to go out and find food and water. I think that's something that perhaps the Americans would like to see. It is something perhaps the Israelis will allow, but they haven't yet indicated that that is the purpose of this. Really, no aid is getting into the northern part of the Gaza Strip. That is, you know, in effect, a war zone. So all we're seeing there are these brief pauses to allow people to get out and perhaps to find some food. But in terms of aid trucks going into the south, that is something which remains problematic and patchy. But there are concerted efforts by the Israelis, the Americans and the Egyptians to try and increase that amount, because that's where the bulk of the Palestinian civilian population is now. And it is in everyone's interest that they're not starving or dying of thirst.
And Paul, what could you tell us about this video of two hostages that's been released by Islamic Jihad?
So this is the smaller of the two main Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip, Palestinian Islamic Jihad. They have released a video in which you see two hostages. One is Hannah Katzir. She's a woman in her 70s. She's sitting in a wheelchair. She was abducted from kibbutz near Oz on October the 7th. And the second hostage is a 13-year-old boy, Yagil Yaakov, who was also taken from the same community. They're both speaking to the camera. We do not know if they're reading a script or speaking their own words. They are both critical of Benjamin Netanyahu for getting them into this situation. But again, I should emphasize, we do not know if these are their words or not. And the Islamic Jihad also put out a statement at the same time saying that the group was willing to release both of these hostages for what it called humanitarian and medical reasons, but only if, again, what it called appropriate measures were met. And we do not know exactly what those measures are. I mean, this comes amid a lot of talk and a lot of diplomatic effort aimed at trying to get hostages released. And it seems as though Islamic Jihad perhaps wants to be part of any deal that is struck.
Paul Adams. More than 1.5 million Gazans are believed to have been displaced in the ongoing conflict. And the UN estimates that about 45% of homes in Gaza have already been destroyed. One person whose life has been turned upside down by the fighting is Abdel Hakim Awad, a 23-year-old social media manager for the Gaza Sunbirds, Gaza's only paracycling team. His building in central Gaza is home to about 400 people, 120 of them members of his own extended family. He says he has no political affiliations. We checked his social media and found no statements supporting Hamas. The BBC's Heba Bitar reflects now on how his life has changed.
Abdul Hakim's home has just been hit. Fear, confusion, darkness, the air thick with smoke. Before the war, Abdul Hakim worked for the Gaza Sunbirds, the Strip's only paracycling team. When Israel's missiles began to strike, he turned to helping those in need.
Me and the young people of the Sunbirds team have raised money to provide urgent supplies. Even our kids are helping to carry stuff. People of all ages are helping to supply and support the shelters across the Gaza Strip. Many of the supermarkets and shops are closed, so supplies are scarce. But we managed to do a tour of all the shops in the central area of Gaza City. Although movement is risky with all the missile strikes, we gathered blankets, groceries, and health products. While we are still alive, we can still help.
That night, a missile struck his apartment block in the Burej refugee camp. It's a building that housed 400 people. A quarter of them were family.
These rockets that landed on us were huge barrel rockets that destroyed the whole area, including a large part of my house. We barely got out of the house. I suddenly looked for my parents, my neighbors, and all those around me and found no one. Our cars were destroyed. We used these cars to transport and distribute the aid to people displaced from their homes. We live every minute, every hour, surrounded by death. This is the worst period we have lived in all of the previous wars. Israel is practicing genocide against us. After almost 2 hours, I found a part of my family, and I was able to reach them. But till today, I haven't been able to get in touch with my neighbors. I'm a civilian. I'm not part of any organization, nor are my family. But the bombing of our house is normal, as is the bombing of the houses of all our neighbors. An entire residential block, a whole neighborhood was bombed.
The buildings are now bare, exposed broken floors. The few cars that remain have been crushed by debris, and clothing is strewn all around.
The missiles don't show any mercy on anyone. We found birds, cats, pigeons, all dead.
It wasn't long before the missiles struck again. 4 days later,
we heard the sound of rockets coming down. We had been bombed before. They killed an entire family. 3 or 4 families.
Abdul Hakim Awad, ending that report by Heba Bita. Nearly 2 weeks after his abduction sparked a major manhunt, the father of the Liverpool football star, Luis Diaz, has been released by a Colombian rebel group, the ELN. Both his parents were kidnapped while they were driving in the family's hometown, Barrancas, in northern Colombia. His mother was freed within hours, but his father, Luis Manuel Diaz, was kept captive by the guerrilla group. Our correspondent Daniel Pardo told me more about the first TV pictures of the release of the father of the famous footballer.
We just saw images of him getting off a helicopter in which he was picked up by officials of the United Nations. The ELN has said that they didn't know he was the dad of this public international figure and that they wouldn't have done it if they knew that it was him. And this is a quote, "We all love Luis Diaz." In their words, this was a mistake. It was a calm sort of release. Day after day, they say it was going to happen and it didn't happen. And that is partly because they were in a very remote area, in a mountainous jungle, but also because distrust between the government and the ELN is so huge, so historical, so profound, that it's very difficult to think they're not going to arrest us. On top of that, this is a guerrilla movement which is trying to negotiate a peace deal with the current government of Gustavo Petro. The political implication of this is bigger.
Daniel, have they been asked about the circumstances surrounding the negotiations behind his release, and indeed if a ransom was paid?
We don't know if the ransom was paid. I would think that it wasn't, because no one wins with this situation. The ELN is trying to negotiate this peace deal. And for them, they need credibility. They need Colombians to think that they have, you know, intentions of peace, intentions of demobilizing, intentions of stopping kidnappings and drug dealing and so forth. One of the questions now is, what's going to happen with this peace negotiation between the government and the guerrilla movement? What Diaz has said previous to the release is that he is not the only one. The ELN has at least 30 people kidnapped. So he had a special treatment because of the fact that he is an international well-known figure that most Colombians love. But there's still people kidnapped by the ELN and other groups. And it's important to understand that violence is still in place in Colombia. It's not the same as it used to be in the 80s and 90s, but it's still in place. And Colombians are still trying to get peace to this country.
Daniel Pardo. If you're a woman suffering extremes of temperature, perspiration and brain fog, you may have told workmates, "I'm sorry, I'm having a hot flush." One woman did that not just to the office, but also to millions of people watching her live on air on Australian national television. Here's a clip from ABC News Breakfast.
The latest on the Prime Minister's visit to China.
Yes, another pardon, Michael. Big chill, but the PM doesn't pander yet. So the bilateral meeting between Australia and China, Anthony Albanese and Chinese. I'm so sorry. I could keep stumbling through this, but I am having such a perimenopausal flush right now, live on air. I'm so sorry.
Imogen, the point about this is that we need to make it normal to have these kinds of conversations, and I love you for even saying it.
Well, the woman having the hot flush was Imogen Crump, the editor of the University of Melbourne's research news platform, Pursuit. As you heard there, she's also a regular paper reviewer on ABC's News Breakfast programme in Australia. Emma Barnett caught up with Imogen and started by checking on her temperature.
My temperature is moderate right now. I will let you know if it spikes as we go on. It's a regular slot that I do. They'll have a journo who comes in and talks through the big stories. It was quite a normal morning. We were talking about the Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's trip to China, which is a big thawing in relations. And I had what can only be described as molten lava that rolls up from your feet to the tip of your head with needle spikes. And you can't think. And I just could not get the words Xi Jinping out of my mouth. And so I had to explain what was happening, or I would look bad at my job.
By saying it, some people, and I'm seeing this on the messages we're getting from some of our listeners this morning, they also fear they'll look bad at their job. It's kind of, some people view it as a lose-lose.
I think for a lot of women, it is a catch-22. And I think I was lucky enough to have the response of Lisa Miller, who is one of the presenters on the program, who immediately stepped in and said, of course we should be honest about this. And Michael Rowland as well was very supportive. I think in that moment, you're kind of thinking in bullet points, right? I was kind of thinking, how do I explain what's happening without telling the truth? I had to say something. And so it was a very quick decision to kind of say, well, no, this is the reality of what's happening. And I can't say the words Xi Jinping right now. And Lisa said, this should be normal. 50% of the population go through it at some point in their lives.
How's the reaction been?
Genuinely lovely. From all walks of life, very supportive. I work at the University of Melbourne, and I was in a meeting this morning, and one of my very senior male colleagues at the end of the meeting said, oh, I just want to talk about Imogen's appearance on the ABC. It helped me raise a conversation with my wife about her perimenopause. And then that flowed on to a conversation with our two teenage daughters. I'd prefer it wasn't my perimenopause they were talking about, but I think if people are having open and honest conversations about an issue that everyone knows happens but doesn't necessarily talk about, then that's a good thing.
Imogen Crump speaking to Emma Barnett. Still to come on the Global News podcast, the pigeon which saved lives lost at sea.
She developed a nervous twitch, which was a result of the huge ordeal that she'd been through.
A new study has shown that lightning is the main cause of forest fires in the Northern Hemisphere, and climate change will significantly increase the number of strikes. The researchers found that with each degree the Earth warms up, the amount of lightning increases by almost a third, threatening to release carbon dioxide stored in the trees into the atmosphere. Here's our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath.
Scientists now believe that lightning strikes like this one are the major ignition source for forest fires such as those that raged in Canada this summer. Around 45 million acres of forest and land were burnt, six times the average area lost over the past 10 years. Smoke from these fires darkened the skies in distant cities across North America, even drifting across the Atlantic to Europe. This new study suggests that the vast majority of fires, such as those seen in Canada, Russia and other areas in the north of the hemisphere, are not started by humans, but by lightning. They also found that a hotter planet was likely to increase the frequency of lightning in these regions. Every degree of warming would see the number of lightning strikes in these undisturbed forests go up by between 11 and 31%. Dr. Thomas Janssen from the Free University of Amsterdam is the study's lead author.
With the warming climate, we will have more lightning in boreal regions, so in Russia and in Canada. And that in combination with a drying climate, a warming climate, there will also be more fires from these lightning strikes.
The researchers say that more lightning poses a significant problem because these trees store vast quantities of carbon, as do the soils they grow in. More fires from lightning will send more CO2 into the atmosphere, increasing the cycle of warming. The authors say there's little that can be done to avoid the increase. The best hope lies in limiting warming by rapidly curbing other sources of carbon.
Matt McGrath. The government in Kenya has been accused of illegally evicting indigenous people from their homes in the Mau Forest, the largest forest in the country. The government says it's working to mitigate climate change by driving out those who damage the forests illegally. Lucy Claridge is director of the International Laws Project based in London. She's represented the Ogiek people since 2010 and has been speaking to James Menendez.
The Ogiek are an indigenous community who live in the Mau Forest in Kenya's Rift Valley. And in 2017, they won a case before the African Court of Human and People's Rights against the government of Kenya, declaring that they are the ancestral landowners, the legal owners of their land in the Mau Forest, where they've lived since time immemorial. And the land should have been returned to them pursuant to a further order of the African Court in 2022. And effectively, the Kenyan government has taken no steps to implement that ruling and is now taking steps to directly contravene it by evicting the Ogiek of a certain location in Narok. The community have been wholly evicted from their homes. Their homes have been destroyed and burnt. Their school has been destroyed. They have nowhere to go. It's particularly cold in Kenya at the moment as well, and rainy. So they're effectively homeless.
The Kenyan government, they say it's in the name of encroachment and illegal logging activities. Is there any evidence that the Ogiek are cutting down parts of the forest illegally?
There's no evidence that I've seen. The Ogiek live in harmony with the forest. They respect it. They rely upon it for their livelihoods, for their identity, their spirituality. And in fact, this was an argument that the Kenyan government ran before the African Court in 2017. They argued that to conserve the forest, the Ogiek needed to be evicted. And the court, in fact, found that firstly, there was no evidence of the Ogiek destroying the forest. And secondly, that conservation did not justify the eviction of the Ogiek from their homes in the Mau Forest.
There's been some suggestion that this is about carbon credits offsetting, in other words, planting trees to make money, I guess, from organisations that help companies and governments offset their carbon emissions. Is that what's going on? Is there anything to that?
The motivation is not quite clear at present. However, it is being done for reasons of conservation. which I use in a very loose term. And the government has also indicated recently that it has funds to conserve the forest and it will be receiving funding to do so. And therefore, there are concerns that systems of carbon offsetting and carbon credits are having very negative implications for the Ogiek, but also for other forest peoples in Kenya, because conservation and carbon offsetting can often be used to evict people from their homes. I still think we don't fully understand the implications of carbon offsetting and all of these apparent environmental frameworks that are being put in place.
Finally, I mean, are there legal avenues that can be pursued to prevent these evictions continuing?
Well, the Ogiek are already protected by two rulings from the African Court, which are legally binding on Kenya. What I would ask is that the Kenyan government respects the ruling from the African Court and implements the ruling. And I would say that if the Kenyan government would like to conserve the Mau Forest, then the Ogiek are the best people to do that.
Lucy Claridge. China views the self-governed island of Taiwan as part of its territory. And since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, there's been growing international concern that Beijing could do the same to its neighbour. China's increased military activity has seen Taiwan scale up its defence capabilities. In September, it unveiled its first homemade submarine. And from January next year, it'll extend the duration of mandatory military service for all men from 4 months to a year. Nuala McGovern was given rare access to some of Taiwan's military facilities.
I'm here at Jai Air Base. What you're hearing in the background there is a Black Hawk helicopter used for search and rescue missions. But behind it is an F-16 Viper. There's the first one that is taking off above this airbase.
If there were to be a serious incident in Taiwanese airspace, jets like the US-made F-16s may well be the first to intercept that intrusion. Major Chiang Yen-ju, call sign Drama, is one of Taiwan's elite pilots.
With a communist aircraft harassing us really frequently, we have to maintain our training and make ourselves prepared and ready for any challenge that we may come up with.
I'm under a single aircraft hangar. This is bomb-proof, and actually, you wouldn't really know it's here if you were looking from the sky down. And I've also got with me Colonel Lin. He is the political warfare director of this unit and has been with the Air Force for 26 years. So what do you think is the biggest challenge when it comes to being prepared?
Frankly, that will be demanding our every single pilot to be as prepared, as trained as possible. You will find that the security situation is getting worse if you're looking at a global picture. What we do is to prepare ourselves the best we can.
Mainland China is just 160 kilometers across the Taiwan Strait. And one concern is what are described as grey zone activities by China in or near Taiwan's coastal waters, where it's alleged that fishing vessels are used by the authorities in Beijing to keep an eye on Taiwan. I went to the headquarters of the Coast Guard Administration in Taipei to meet Rear Admiral Lin, Chow Lin. He spent a long career in the Navy and now he's been tasked with helping the Taiwanese Coast Guard make that rapid transition from peacetime to wartime should the moment arrive.
As you know, we cannot compare the numbers with China. We have enough forces to protect our waters right now. However, we need to have new ships to deter new threats.
I've seen some radar maps with you. There are thousands of vessels. How do you figure out what might be a potential aggressor?
Every day, PRC China fishing boat come across our 24 nautical miles. So recent years, we have detained many this kind of fishing boats.
Do you think in this coming year, Taiwan will remain at peace?
That depends. For my personal views, I believe we have maybe 3 or 4 years
before any incident?
Yes.
With mainland China?
I believe so, yeah.
That report from Nuala McGovern. Meta, the company that owns the social media sites Facebook and Instagram, is cracking down on political adverts on its platforms to counter misinformation and deepfake videos. It follows increasing concern that AI technology could influence the result of elections around the world. I got more from our technology reporter, Imran Raman-Jones.
What we're talking about here is deepfake. So that's when AI is used to change what someone says or what they do in a video, and the audio can be changed or even in a picture. So we saw the Pope in a puffer jacket, that picture which fooled a lot of people earlier this year. It can also be used for other things like undermining election integrity or in conflicts like in Russia and Ukraine.
And what is Meta planning to do?
What Meta is asking advertisers to do is, when it comes to political adverts and also adverts to do with social issues, they're telling the advertisers they need to mark the adverts and tell them when they've used digital manipulation in them. And then that will show a marker to the user on the other end that this advert has been manipulated digitally.
I mean, it sounds as if they're going to depend a lot on those who are uploading. So arguably, quite a lot of deepfakes and misinformation might still get through.
Well, I did put this to them and they said, because they have their existing misinformation rules in place, this is really about making it clearer. Some people could say it's them being asked to mark their own homework, but Meta, the owner of Facebook and Instagram, say that they have moderation in place, which is done by AI itself and also by people, to make sure that these don't get through.
There's been a lot of concern about this misinformation and deepfake videos. Has there been a tipping point? Has there been one election, do you think, when they have decided, Meta has decided something has to be done?
They've definitely been used in elections before, not just on Meta platforms, but on other online platforms. So there were some examples in India a few years ago of deepfakes being used. The worry is, I guess, there's a lot of elections coming up in 2024, and the technology is getting so good that they're really hard to spot now. So they will become more important in election campaigning.
Imran Raman-Jones. A carrier pigeon called Winky has been honoured after saving the lives of four people whose plane crashed into freezing waters during the Second World War. The pigeon managed to fly home and raise the alarm and has now been honoured with a bronze statue in its Scottish hometown. Our Scotland correspondent, Lorna Gordon, takes up the story.
The badly damaged Beaufort bomber ditched in the freezing waters of the North Sea after returning from a mission over Norway. It was common practice at the time to carry pigeons on military aircraft for last-minute emergency communications, and unable to radio the plane's position, the crew released two of them in the hope that at least one pigeon would make it home to raise the alarm. One never made it back, but the second, called Winky, was discovered exhausted and covered in oil by its owner in Broughty Ferry, who alerted the Air Force. Nicholas Milton, who has written a book about the role birds played in the First and Second World Wars, takes up the story.
Her owner calculated how far she had flown, and when the plane had gone down, the RAF hadn't been able to get an exact location for it, and therefore they were looking in completely the wrong place. Now, when Winky got back, they were able to calculate much more accurately the area.
The crew were rescued, and the bird was celebrated for her 120-mile flight in appalling conditions.
There was a dinner held for Winky, and she had pride of place at the dinner. This was where she developed a nervous twitch, which was a result of the huge ordeal that she'd been through. And her eye was winking all the time, and that's how she got her name.
The pigeon was retired from her role in serving the military. Now a statue marking her bravery has been unveiled facing the Scottish waters, in which the Second World War crew might have died had Winky not made it home.
Lorna Gordon reporting. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
And now, a road report from Siemens Energy.
The road to energy resilience
is long and winding.
But step by step,
we're making progress.
With renewable energy,
with stronger grid technologies,
hydrogen-ready gas turbines,
and e-fuels for hard-to-decarbonize industries.
We are driving towards that destination every day.
Step by step, we are getting there.
Find out how at SiemensEnergy.com.
Let's make tomorrow different today.
From hedge funds to angel investors to bull markets. In the world of finance, names can sometimes be a bit misleading. Take ours, for instance. LSEG, a.k.a. London Stock Exchange Group. We're in London, and we have a stock exchange, but that's just part of what we do. Today, we connect the news, information, insights, and systems that make the markets work. You see, others do some of what we do, but not everything we do. LSEG.